Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict predecided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedies in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we can disclose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Dang, this whole time I'm talking and the microphone is muted. I'm so sorry, everyone. It was a great conversation. You should have been there. Sorry. Tonight's conversation, John will be joining us very shortly, and we will be talking about money.
I'm going to put this
money will be the discussion tonight. There's actually two kinds of money in operation in the United States. And let me put this into lecture mode because we have everybody's microphone open here.
Fucking halted, dude.
Stand by. There we go. John, like I said, will be joining us in just a moment. And it's very exciting. I have the honor and the privilege of attending these auditing and putting together the different calls that John or Bernie or others have with the information providers, GW, with the students. And I get to learn so much. Michael, you've raised your hand, so let me unmute you real quick and see if we can't get a question answered from you.
Good evening.
Go ahead, Mike. Good evening.
Got sent to a text because you were muted out, and it all went off.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Listen, I apologize, everyone. I'm sitting here having a conversation, trying to figure out why my board is not responding properly, and then I realized I had muted myself. I do that sometimes. John is here tonight, and he's just arrived. John, I shared with people that we're going to talk about money tonight and how money is in two different categories. So take it away.
Good evening, all. Once again, it's an honor and a privilege to address you. To that end, Michael and I are working, and the whole team that serves you is working very hard as information providers to round out your education so that you have a better idea of how things got the way they are and how to handle them. There's a couple of old sayings. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And also, knowledge is power, and a little bit of knowledge is a little bit of power, and a lot of bit of knowledge is a lot of bit of power. So to that end, many times it's good to go back to the beginning where certain things that affected our lives daily began. And to that, one of those, and there's been some smatterings of this education going on, but for the next few weeks and maybe month or two, we're probably going to alternate in the be in between the regular sessions, what we're going to call building block sessions. And to that end, we're going to start with the background that and slowly work up to where we're at now in this day and age when things are not what they used to be many years ago. After the instructional time is done, the information provision time is done, when Michael opens it up to questions, the regular questions to an answer period will be open to all questions, not just those that were that relate directly to the subject material and the subject matter that was covered that particular evening. So always feel free to, shall we say, have your questions prepared and ready. Have your bullets in your gun ready to shoot. And to that end, tonight, the title of this evening's discussion is Old Roman Money. And there are those of you that already know what this is. Some of you have a vague idea. Some of you may not have any idea or even heard the term before. And so before we go into the information moment here, I'm going to beg your grace and your indulgence. For those of you who are already aware of a portion of this, or maybe even all of it, I'll thank you for your grace and your patience in advance, in hopes that you can help augment the others, should you ever have the opportunity to answer their questions, at stepping up on the next level of education. In previous times, going back to the times before the Common Era, or before Christ, there were families that had, in the day, in the Greco-Roman Empire, had amassed unbelievable fortunes, not just in within the confines of the Greco-Roman Empire, which would later be considered just strictly the Roman Empire, but amassed these fortunes throughout the known world at that time. And I say known world because during these times, much of the other portions of the globe were not as well understood as they could be now. And I'll use the term as well understood because it's much to our chagrin and shock. Much of the world was occupied at that time. And it had been tamed and we had civilized world there. But in the times previous to Christ in the Greco-Roman Empire, there were very wealthy individuals that from time to time were concerned that with the fact that they had challenges that needed to be addressed both domestically and sometimes internationally with their assets abroad. And when the when challenges arose, sometimes they would seek an audience with the Roman Emperor and try to see if he would sway to their cause and, if necessary, send troops to certain areas, not necessarily because there was a legitimate socio-political difficulty, but because their fiscal interests were at risk. And many of them, in an effort to court favor, had no problems with sometimes lavishing not just gifts on the aristocracy that was in power at the time, the legitimate government heads, but even when it got serious, they would loan them money. And eventually it became that they began to not just loan them money for day-to-day political operations and the whatnot of the day, but also they began to loan them a little extra to lavish their lifestyle intentionally, to the point where they began to imbibe upon this lavishness to the point where they were drunk on it. And originally there were three very prominent families that began to loan the Emperor of Rome very significant funding, and significantly greater than the taxation that they were getting from the known world at the time. And their taste for lavishness and delicacies of not just of fine art but and food, but of people, and it became very costly. And to that end, these families had no problem with lavishing the Emperor of Rome with these loans. And eventually it got to the place where the Emperor could no longer pay back the loans that were made. And then the King of Spain, having a challenge that they were indebted to Rome, these families agreed, the three agreed, and there soon would be a very wealthy fourth, agreed that with the King of Spain, look, you know what, we're going to pay off your debt to Rome, and then you'll just owe us, you'll owe us instead of Rome, and you know what, we'll discount that debt to you. And they did. And they, to the Emperor of Rome, they said, look, Spain owes you this much money. We're going to subtract that off the books so that you no longer, you know, they no longer owe you the money and you no longer owe us the money. And we're going to take care of that debt for them. And they did discount the debt to the King of Spain, kind of, sort of. Except that now he was in debt to them, and they were now collecting usury or interest, as you please. And later on, and this is the first time that major transactions would occur without any currency of intrinsic value would be physically moved from one country to the next. This is a monumental occasion, very, very serious. Later, the King of Spain would now, having an excellent relationship with these families that are and is growing, would borrow money themselves. And so the King of Spain and the Emperor of Rome were now indebted to these families. And sometimes when the interest of these families suited such, they would invite the king or the emperor to sometimes embark on a crusade on their behalf, mostly to protect their financial interests, but very much under the cover of sociopolitical advent. And that was something that it seemed fairly clean. And to encourage them, they would offer them a reduction of the debt. They would even offer to fund the crusade and give them a discount on their debt. And so it became very much in the favor of Rome and Spain to honor these families' requests. Later on, when the King of Prussia got into a little bit of a tangle with Spain and then Rome, these families agreed to, quote-unquote, make it right. And the King of Prussia became very indebted to them, and they, once again, remediated a little bit of the debt that Spain and Rome had on their books. And this was happening so quietly that 99.999 to 11 decimal places of humanity would never know that the, this type of monetary transaction was ever existing. This would later proceed on into the not just into the well into the first few centuries, but into the first millennia, and then even into the second millennia. And there's families that that to this day are you've heard of some of them, the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, and a lot of the some of the oldest Dutch families, the Vanderbilts, and as such, as they they've the Rothschilds are paupers. They're only worth about $400 billion on the books. Off book is a completely different story. But what happens is that they began to manage debts so liberally that they began to control economies, as it were. And they conspired that if they had a monetary instrument that, while it carried a potential face value, did not have any intrinsic value, they believed that if they controlled that in the whole world, they could not only control the world, but become richer than anybody's wildest dreams. To that end, what happened was is that currency of intrinsic value, being like gold and silver, began in their eyes to be frowned upon. Well, let's just say they frowned upon the common person having any of it. They would rather that they had something that they could adjust the value of, so that when this country's value was up to here and that one was down there, they could buy or sell whatever amount of that currency that they wanted to. And then when they adjusted the values, they could sell it back. And at any time they pleased, they could siphon off or farm off the profits of any country that was using a paper currency, or the word fiat currency began to come into play. A few of these families got together in the early teens of the last century and took a young politician named Winston Churchill aside and explained to him that they would like to help him, and they would like to get to know him a little bit better. And they explained to him that it was probably a little bit unwise to not accept their kind overture. To that end, they explained how they were going to fund this first set of international games, and that they explained exactly how it would end, how it would start, you know, the ebb and tide of the war, and how the First World War, the first international games, would end. They also explained to this young politician that they were going to prop up some of this stock in the American market in such a way that that what they would do is that they would crash the market at their pleasure. To that end, in 1929, in October of 1929, when they pulled out their funds, they did not leave enough in the bank to cover all the payroll that was necessary for that for the following Friday. On that Black Monday of October 28, 1929, when the Dow Jones declined nearly 13% in one day, and they moved money around in such a way that not just the payrolls at over 3% of the U.S. corporations could not be made, but that the stock market, the funding that they normally had there, would not survive till Thursday. Actually, that was their original plan. It was not supposed to survive till Thursday, the 31st of October. But on Tuesday, the 29th of October, all of those reserves were gone. By Friday, bodies laying on the sidewalk because they would either jump from their office window or from the roof was a unbelievably commonplace appearance. But they explained all of this to this young politician, Winston Churchill, well in advance. And so as Winston Churchill watched the First World War unfold almost exactly as these overly thoughtful citizens had planned. Remember, they were making their money by selling weapons and funding both sides of the conflict. They were impartial and non-prejudicial participants in matters of war and death. They are completely nonpartisan, and they're impartial. They is only matters of money that they are partial in. And so what happened was is that they also explained that to that end that it was their desire to create a system where they would loan America money. And if you should have the chance to read a book by G. Edward Griffin called The Creature from Jekyll Island, you'll find out that there's a an interesting background that G. Edward Griffin he tells a very, very serious story. As a child, I remember Ed Griffin sharing with my father the research that he was putting into his book back in the 60s, and that he would later publish in the 70s. And he tried to publish it back then. It wouldn't be finally published till July of 1994. But there's a but The Creature from Jekyll Island is a very, very interesting, very historical overview of a meeting at a resort island called Jekyll Island off the east coast of America, that where the financial in managers or money managers of the day decided that they that's where the they decided they wanted to set up the Federal Reserve and how it was, how it was to function, and that the American dollar bill would be rented or leased to the United States for the whopping sum of one-third of a penny per year. The only caveat was is that that rent had to be paid in gold. And some people say, well, there's, look at all the gold in Fort Knox. And ask yourself, who owns that gold? And I'm certain that many of you have, you know, heard the stories that 110 West Wall Street there, they, has, more gold in it than any other single, repository in the world. And, on book, that is very, very true. The nations that, use that as their repository, for gold, not just gold, but, paper currency as well, it's world renowned. Now, I'm not saying that this place really exists, but there may be, she's now a widow, but in South Korea, in Seoul, South Korea, that, on the outskirts toward Incheon, that, there is, 28 stories to her basement. There are two freight elevators, of seven that are large enough to drive a semi into. The floors are the equivalent of 21 and a half feet high. In some of these floors, there's just pallets and pallets of currency of different international denominations. And in three floors, I did not see anything else other than U.S. currency. Oh, I'm not saying this place actually exists. But on four of the floors, the gold is stacked eight pallets high. And the bars on the gold, there's more gold in two of her floors than there is in Fort Knox. She's sitting on an unbelievable amount of currency, and she lamented when India canceled all the large denoms that it hurt her pretty badly. Srisiman, Yamade Hasasui Simika, Osayo, I just asked anybody if anybody spoke any Korean, and I just said hello. India, for those of you who have been a little bit familiar with some of the international currency, canceled all their large denoms a few years back. Large denominations. I use the term denom for short for denomination. The new rupee, we were involved in a project. It was a very, very small project. It was a technology project, back in 16 and 17, we were in the middle. We had a SBLC for $20 million, U.S. But the standby letter of credit, what happens is that, a lot of these financiers and the financial individuals in that market, what they do is, and I'll speak exclusively for India, because that's the case study we're going to use tonight, that what happens is that a lot of these large corporations, they would, at Chase Manhattan, in Manhattan, at 110 West Wall Street, Chase Bank and B of A Bank in downtown L.A., many of the banks around the world, the Bank of Tokyo in Tokyo, they would have not just a little bit of currency in their accounts, but they literally had pallets of actual physical currency on deposit in their vaults. And when I say pallets, they would have the 10,000 rupee notes. In one particular bank, they had 62 pallets of 10,000 rupee notes in there from one depositor alone. And when they would seek to use a SBLC, a standby letter of credit, or any one of the other monetary instruments that an individual might use, they would use this money as collateral for this international instrument. So that what happened was is that though the bank was in Madrid, Spain, and I'll speak to one where I was told where they had 26 pallets of the 10,000 rupee notes there, that they issued a $20 million SBLC against that collateral in that particular bank that was owned by this one family. What happened was that when India called the large denoms due, they gave them 72 hours to turn them in and cash them in. They were saying it was to prevent tax evasion. But what happened was is that India wiped out 92% of all of their debt in one event where three individuals that I am aware of personally purchased one or more 747s that they filled the aircraft to max gross, and a 747 grosses, these grossed in at 890,000 pounds. And when they took off their max takeoff weight, it was exclusively because they had fuel and pallets of dollar bills in LD7 and LD10 containers in the cargo bins. They were at max gross, and they were trying to fly this money to India as fast as they could. They couldn't get the aircraft fast enough to redeem this, and many of them lost everything. A $20 million standby letter of credit that we had that theoretically is irrevocable was canceled. Was canceled by none other than Chase Manhattan Bank here in the States, because the rupee that they had in their bank in New York was now worthless. The money had been completely, in one instant, literally from 1 week to the next, that was completely, we did our SPLC had already been we had already transacted it, and it was still canceled. And so what happened was that this government, having paper / fiat currency, they were able to manipulate the value of that currency at their will. Theoretically, the U.S., Great Britain, all the folks that that like to participate with the International Clearance Bank, all eight of them that exist around the world, they set the value of the dollar and the pound, etc., the euro, based on the distribution of gold that is available at any single one time. And what happens is that they relatively know how much heavy metal this country is holding, and that, you know, and there's for when you refer to what might be in, set aside for industrial purposes, and, you know, like insulation and electrical conductors and plating for circuit boards and things like that, they relatively know how much is out there, and so they set a value. Now, what, you know, if you only have 1 pound of gold and you print one dollar bill that has a specific value of that 1 pound of gold, that monetary note, and when you look at your monetary instrument, it's a dollar bill with the emphasis on bill as in debt instrument. When you say a $10 note, that's what it is. It's a debt instrument. It used to be that the silver certificates, gold certificates, you could redeem them for actual heavy metal. But when gold was outlawed in 1933, everybody had to turn it in. You could no longer redeem it for heavy metal. So what happens is that now it was a fiat or a relative setting of that. Now, they say that based on their gold holdings, they're able to print this amount of dollars. Well, if they print $1 more than the value of that gold, technically the value of every one of the other dollars just depreciated for the value of that dollar that they added. They printed extra. And if somebody like Joe Biden goes and prints $20 billion more in 3 days, what happens is that the value of the currency in your pocket, they just stole from you. They just stole that much money from the American public, from the American people. It's not that he had the right there and that there was any intrinsic value in that currency that he, what he did was he just stole from everyone, the American people, $20 billion worth of the value of what they received in their paycheck. They did not increase your paycheck to account for quote unquote inflation. And it's actually not inflation, it's deflation. They've decreased the value of the dollar bill that you hold. They're stealing from you. They do not, they, right now, oh, wait a minute. Why would anybody want to do that? I wonder if there were some puppets from that managed the money of the world that were trying to steal from the people and reduce them to paupers in from, to a two-class society. They would be wanting to allow for inflation. Anytime there's new money put in the system, where's the gold to back that up? Did I miss something? Was I not very bright? Character of monetary instruments that bear intrinsic value, you know, and in the, wait a minute, John, there was something in the Constitution about no state can mint any money except gold or silver. Yeah, that's true. It didn't say anything about the federal government not being able to do it. It says, don't do as I do as I say. We're going to hold you to a standard, but us, in liberality, not saying that we've got left the door open so we can steal from the people, but we're going to leave the door open so we can steal from the people. But we didn't say that. But like in India, many families lost everything when it was reduced to the fact that they, the 20 rupee note, everything else had to be done electronically, even the folks that had money in the cookie jar couldn't redeem it, and they lost the value of their life savings that was in the cookie jar. Anybody that was in the hospital lost everything that they couldn't turn it in and exchange it. There was no mercy when India canceled all the large denoms. Now, what happens is that, you mentioned something about that widow, John. Yeah, that's a good point. What happens if that widow goes and takes just a few pallets of U.S. $100 bills to the tune of, $20 or $50 million and dumps it onto the market? Wait a minute. Now there's a lot more money out in the system than there was the day before, and the gold fixing for that. Now what happens is that there's so much extra money that now we could actually, the value is decreasing and we could lose businesses. Now, so what happens is that the Fed has to very, very quickly buy back a lot of that money. They've got to buy it back very quickly, because if there's too much money running around, the value of goods depreciates very, very quickly. If you only have $10 and you want to buy five apples, you may be willing to give 50 cents or even a dollar for those five apples. But if you've got $10,000, you may give them a 10 or a 20 or maybe even a $100 tip for those five apples. And now everybody else that has apples for sale, their price depreciates very quickly. And now they cannot make their mortgage payment. They can't buy groceries. They can't make their car payment. And what happens is the economy begins to crash. It used to be that on every 28 days, the international clearance banks worldwide, everybody had to balance their books. But because of people like that widow and others that have pillowcases and mattresses that they stuff with currency, as they begin to draw on this currency and they have their own little private savings bank in fiat currency, but they've got their private savings bank, now all of a sudden, if one of them dumps a bunch on the market, that can even a minor dump like that could have major localized repercussions. So what happened was they decided they would start balancing the books on the money and what was available in the market every 7 days. And in 1992, it dropped to every 5 days. And in 2003, it dropped to every day. And in 2009, it dropped to every 12 hours. It's now every 6 hours. Every 6 hours, all of the banks worldwide have to balance. And they have to balance so that if that widow gets on that little Yazoo forklift and puts two of those pallets in the back of a bobtail truck and sends it to the local Bank of Korea, we, the U.S., are in serious trouble. the moment that money hits the market worldwide, if all of the banks, U.S. banks worldwide, and everyone that responds to the international currency banks, if they don't get the extra funds reeled in very, very quickly, there could be a crash of the monetary system. Now, conversely, if individuals have open SBLCs, open monetary instruments, or the ability to make large withdrawals at one time, they can actually create a situation where a bank can no longer have the money so that the local businesses can even make payroll. So, holy broken tree feathers, Batman. That could trigger a 1929 moment, you know. That could be an October 28th, 1929 moment, Black Monday, you know, ouch. Okay, what happens is that international laws, internationally, almost every country in the world has enacted laws that if a bank does not have the capacity to remain solvent, they do not have to honor a withdrawal request. I'll say that again. In the U.S., if a bank feels that you're asking for too much money, they do not have to give it to you, even if it is yours. And for whatever time is necessary, they are not required to honor it. And what it means is that your business can crash, theirs doesn't. You're the one that can go to the poorhouse, they not them. But what's happened is that they've created a situation that to prevent that type of catastrophic socioeconomic behavior that occurred on October 28th, 1929, they've passed laws so that the banks don't risk that occurring to them. Now, what it means is that when that occurs and the money's gone, there is a crash, there is a problem. But what they've done is they've lowered the pay scale of the crash down to the individual depositor and not the bank. Meaning, you and I are the ones that suffer, not them. So to that end, what happens is that the moment we deal with fiat currency and not intrinsic currency, meaning currency of intrinsic value, meaning that maybe it's a silver dollar or a $10 or $50 gold piece, but it's a paper debt instrument. And by the way, the one thing that makes a debt instrument is that it's the signature. In this case, it's the Secretary of Treasury and the Secretary's. You know, you look at the bottom of the note, and there's two signatures on there, not just one, but two. You know, when you buy a car, there's a loan, there's a note. What makes that note have any value? It's your signature. We're going to have on one of the upcoming weeks, we're going to have a evening discussion that we're going to call the Three Apples, and we're going to talk about what the value of your signature is and why it's so critically important, and why and how it relates to not just an automotive mortgage but your home mortgage, and why that is so vitally important. On another one, we're going to have an evening. Tonight we called it the Old Roman Money. We're going to have another one called The Creature from Jekyll Island. And we'll talk about how they implemented that. And that one is the one that's going to play toward the, it's going to be a big one that's going to give us a lot more information on your status. And now, my time has come to a close. And now I turn it back to Michael for Q&A.
Oh, well, thank you so very much. John, you know that I had to take a second to unmute myself. Ladies and gentlemen, press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Press star 2. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll see to the center of your monitor, to the right center of your monitor, you will see a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. There's nothing inside of it. Just click your left click inside of it, type away your comment or your question, and I'll be happy to give voice to that. On the outside of that rectangle on the bottom, you'll see a place to put your name and the word submit. Click the submit button, and off we go. We'll be glad to talk about it. Again, press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to make a comment or ask a question. I'm hitting refresh. See what we have here. It'll take a moment because it always does. All right, Miss Jennifer, you're first in line.
Barely.
You're unmuted. Oh. Go ahead. Yes.
I waited a while for other people to join in. Hi, John. Hope you're feeling well.
Thank you. Doing better.
Great. Glad to hear it. Does it matter if I talk about a different topic?
Now, the question and answer period, Jennifer Sue, is open to questions on any topic. We would like to give some preference to the topic of the evening, but the question and answer period is open to any topic. Maybe I should qualify that we think we can give you a proper answer for.
Okay. Great. That's good. Well, thank you. I know you haven't had time yet, but I wrote a response letter, a notice of jurisdictional challenge to the traffic court, and I know when you have a moment, you'll be able to check it over. But I don't understand. I don't see why I can't ask them to prove jurisdiction before I even step into their court, because they're calling it an appearance, general appearance, basically, and I'm calling it a special appearance. But if they don't call it a special appearance, then they're basically insinuating I'm jumping into their jurisdiction. And do I have the right to ask them to identify the personam and territorial jurisdiction of the event before I even step foot in their court, so I know how to defend myself when I get there, or through mail?
There's Jennifer, I had there was recently a story of a gentleman who had a similar quandary. He had pretty much given up on trying to get a straight answer from the judge or the prosecutor. They didn't know what they didn't know. And to
right.
that end, what happened was that he called me up and he says, tomorrow morning I'm going in there and I've got three friends and one of them, and I've got a fourth that is a federal marshal, and I'm going to go in there and tell them that I'm challenging jurisdiction. And this was a California court, by the way. And he said he was going to go in there in San Francisco, and if they didn't prove up jurisdiction, they decided to steamroll him. He was going to place everyone that didn't do it under citizen's arrest, and he was going to have the federal marshal as a backup to place, if necessary, the prosecutor and or the judge under arrest for failing to prove up jurisdiction. And he could have technically done it that way legally, The only reason why federal marshals even have the authority to arrest is because citizens bear the original authority for the right of arrest. And it's because they've conveyed that to them or conferred that onto those marshals, and especially that sheriff who, local sheriff who confers it onto deputies when he deputizes them. Those inalienable rights that was reserved for the people were never surrendered or abdicated to the hired help. That includes the federal marshals, the judge, or the sheriff. The people still retain those. But Jimmy, after he was actually crying on the phone saying, I don't know what my wife and three children are going to, if they're going to be fatherless tomorrow, because if it's going to be a shootout in the courtroom and this and that, and he was completely ready to, you know, to be the sacrificial lamb, you know. And I asked him, I says, when you go to war, I know you're ready to give your life for your country, but why don't you make the other guy give his life for his country? You know, Jim started to laugh, you know, and I couldn't, you know, and I finally broke him out of his somber mood. We worked through the night till about 4 that morning, working on educating the judge, you know, and bringing in and to be courteous, Jimmy Ashley asked the judge, says, Your Honor, it would be my honor and privilege to bring an argument for jurisdiction to this court, but to not offend or belabor the other defendants that are here at this time. Could we set mine for the last so that we can have the time for the court's time to be able to cover this? And the judge was so shocked at his request that he honored it. And he says, I can't understand there's anything you could possibly bring forward, but if you're doing this to try to be considerate for your fellow person, he says, more power to you, and I'm going to give it to you. And he told the clerk, set him last, you know, and he did. And as it turned out, Jimmy said that over half of the people in the courtroom stayed to listen to what he had to say. It took him almost 45 minutes to explain everything to the prosecutor and the judge. When the prosecutor and the judge got done explaining, and I was not the only information provider that worked with Jimmy on that one. There were two others, but when I explained to him the gravity of, you know, educating them versus doing battle against them, as it turned out, the prosecutor moved to dismiss his charges. The judge says, you know, I was going to do the same thing, but I'm glad you did it, you know. That way he doesn't have justiciable standing to pursue you because technically that would be a deprivation of civil rights color of law. The judge said that, and apparently when the judge said that, everybody in the courtroom started cheering. This was a while back, Jennifer, but the object is that if we can educate the jurisprudence and the prosecutors on what is right, if we can learn our subject material well enough that we can learn and be able to pass it on and teach with respect and full deference and consideration to those that might be present, then we might have accidentally done something right. To that end, by the way, I spent over an hour and a half on your on the motion for you today. So,
thank you.
I'm still getting over. Actually, you and a widow in Oregon got and a young lady in California got almost all of my time today. There was just three of you that all my waking hours. I'm still struggling to get over the shingles thing, but the pain is just unbelievable. I had to just uncover my legs because the lesions on my legs are so painful. Even the cloth of the blanket on them is just horribly, horribly painful. But I just had to take the blanket off my legs right now. Michael and I were talking. We used your name in vain a couple times today, trying to figure out how soon we could get to you. We're talking about you behind your back, in front of your face. You know,
no wonder
and,
my ears turned.
Pardon?
No wonder my ears turned red.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Well, I was just trying to educate them kind of before I got there, because I'm not very good at remembering things, especially under stressful.
Under stress? Duress?
Duress, yes.
Okay. I was hoping to be able to spend some quality time with you tomorrow. Do you have time in the afternoon, say, between 3 and 4 Eastern, possibly?
I do, yes.
Can you touch base with Michael around, let's make it closer to 4 o'clock Eastern. Just reach out to him. I've got a little widow in Oregon that I need to finish something for. And if I can get hers done, we might save her house. And, in the meantime, if we can have you in the afternoon, I might be able to get her done in the morning. Let's make it 4 o'clock Eastern.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you have any other questions, young lady?
My husband had sores all over his body, and Clariderm, which is a spray, actually with a lot of other oils, helped with getting rid of them, and he also took them internally and got rid of them all. And I just thought you might want to, I don't know if Michael sent you the info I sent
yes,
you.
Yes, he did.
On.
Thank you. Michael's very timely on anything anybody sends him. If something doesn't get forwarded from Michael, it's an uncommon event. It's an uncommonly rare event. Okay. Thanks, girl.
All right.
For the benefit of the listening audience, I'd like to, you know me, I'm a court case guy. If you want to talk about religion, I just quote scripture. I don't give you any opinions. If you want to talk law, I don't give you my opinions. I quote court cases. That's the way I do it. So I want to share some court cases that are going to support everything that John has just talked about. In Stuck versus Medical Examiners, 94 California 2nd, it's very similar to Maine versus Thibodeau at 100 South Court. It says once challenged, jurisdiction cannot be assumed. It must be proved to exist. The other says jurisdiction once challenged cannot be assumed and must be decided. That then follows up with Rescue Army versus Municipal Court of Los Angeles says, quote, a court has no jurisdiction to determine its own jurisdiction. Now that is very interesting. Add to that Lantana versus Hopper, courts must prove on the record all jurisdiction facts related to the jurisdiction asserted, end quote. And Rosemont versus Lambert, the burden shifts to the court to prove jurisdiction, end quote. I mean, how powerful are these cases? How powerful. Anyways, let's go back to...
How can I go into their court? Because I'm assumed that, I mean, it looks like I'm asserting my jurisdiction over to them, to their court.
To
I want them
special
to,
appearance.
I want them to tell me I'm either doing a special appearance or prove jurisdiction.
You've established that when you write in your paperwork each and every time, when you open your mouth each and every time, the first thing uttered is special appearance, not general.
Right.
And you always do that, whether in writing or speaking. Reminding the court, I'm speaking on through special appearance and not general appearance. Blah, blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. All right.
Well,
let's go to next.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Next is Michael out of Las Vegas, Nevada.
Well, good evening. I have a couple of things. One of them with Jennifer there. Her special appearance, if she puts everything in writing first, publishes it, and then records it, and an affidavit with it when she goes into court, there's nothing they have to stand on, practically. And that would be, if she's brave enough to do that. Anyway, the other thing is international exchange on gold between nations, I believe, is still $35 an ounce. But if we're exchanging, if banks are having to clear their books every 6 hours, the accounting has to be done every 6 hours, we're in big trouble, really, really, really big trouble, like any day. They can do the same thing that India did, and I'm sure they want to. They're just afraid of 300 million people with guns. That's
about
the extent of what I...
Don't worry, it's much worse than you think. The whole world does that every 6 hours with the International Clearance Bank now, and they've been doing it that way for a couple of years now.
Yeah, they've got a plan in action, and they're going to exercise their plan.
Well, the reason they have to do this so-called Great Reset and clear the board, if you would, is because they no longer can support their Ponzi scheme. It's blatantly obvious now. And they couldn't. The reason POTUS Trump had to lose, is that he was there to basically expose everything. And, 2022 elections coming up in a few months, if we can get past their cheating, which I don't know that we can, but if we can get past their cheating, then that can open the ground for 2024. What I'd love to see is there's a little unknown rule that the Speaker of the House does not have to be a member of the House. And if the Republicans gain absolute control of the House in a couple of months, they could invite Donald Trump to be Speaker of the House. And boy, would that be fun. Anyway.
They'd have to call every fire department out in the country because it'd be unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Freedoms Radio has a question, and I think I'm going to answer that for. Last night, GW explained the importance of the affidavit and that he keeps it close by him at all times. My question is, should you keep the original with you or a copy? All right, here's what you don't understand, and let's get it clear for everyone. The original affidavit that you made was the original affidavit. You can make 100 original affidavits. There's not a problem with that. And they don't all have to be done the same day. You can choose today, tomorrow morning, to go out and take the same wording and make a new affidavit and have it notarized tomorrow and carry that around with you for a while. You can do it anytime you want and have as many as you want. And that affidavit is what is the correcting of your status. Because at that point, you're the only one on the table that can offer firsthand knowledge. And that becomes authenticated evidence, highest level of evidence. And unless somebody can stand up and say and write another affidavit rebutting your affidavit, who has firsthand knowledge? Who else has firsthand knowledge as to your status? Nobody. John, you want to talk about that a second?
Some of the individuals that I know went ahead and printed 6 or 8 or 10 when they did their first one, and they had every single one of them notarized the same day. And they carry it with them all the time. And that, in the use of that term, special appearance, and does everybody know what the term special appearance means? That's when you challenge a court's jurisdiction over them. If a court doesn't have personal jurisdiction, or there's errors like in service of process, anyone who normally a citizen makes a general appearance, but the jurisdiction and the jurisdiction is issue is automatically waived. But if you, with this affidavit, and yes, you can have photocopies of it. It doesn't have to be an original. I know people that have the original, and it actually has a embossed notary stamp on the original, and they've made photocopies and they laminate them so they keep them in their glove box and they keep them on their person. But the photocopy doesn't carry the raised emboss thing there, but through the plastic coating. But at any turn, there may be an opportunity or a need to produce it. Yeah, make a handful of copies.
Most excellent. All right, thank you, John. And I presume to be our last questionnaire tonight is from Kent in Charleston, West Virginia. Kent, get a microphone. Still
good evening,
muted
Kent.
You. Wait a minute. Now you're unmuted. I'm sorry.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes,
and
thank
we're going to hire you for the next Verizon commercial.
Okay, you can hear me. Very good. First of all, John and Mike, thank you for the information that you're providing in the classes that you're now giving. I appreciate that, and I'm sure from what I've heard, other people appreciate that very much also. I have a couple of questions, but I wanted to pursue what you just said about the affidavit a little further. Wasn't it said in the past that it's actually the filing, if you will, or the recording of the affidavit with the State Department that you've now told someone that has the greatest efficacy rather than just making the affidavit, or do I misunderstand that?
Michael, you want to take that one, or should we invite GW for this one?
Don't know that I can raise him up real quick. I'll try.
Yeah, this might be a good one for GW to take a personal swipe at.
All right, one moment.
Sometimes it's wise to have a fellow constituent that is more studied on a subject, to answer the question. And so to that end, at this juncture, it's my thought that if Michael is able to raise GW, I think he's already answered this question to my hearing before, but he has a way of answering it that other people sometimes have a way of answering questions that sometimes you just don't.
Okay, I have to interrupt. John, let me interrupt you, please, one moment. I have GW here. He only has 2 minutes, no more. So ask your question, Kent, and let's go for the answer.
Okay, GW. I was asking. They were just talking about the affidavit and the making of the affidavit and carrying it around with you, or carrying around copies of the affidavit, which we've talked about before. And that was actually, since you made the affidavit and nobody else has firsthand knowledge that they can challenge with an affidavit, that is what will do the job, along with a special appearance if you're dragged into court. It is my understanding that it is the telling or the informing, recording, filing of that affidavit with, say, the State Department that really adds the efficacy to it. but is the carrying of the affidavit for those of us, you know, I've raised this issue before, that have an issue about who we're filing something with or recording something with from a more purist point of view, you know, the old story that nobody's home down there at the State Department on the de jure side. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say that it's a great thing to get it to the State Department, of course, to have it in your permanent administrative file. But what's even more important, what's more important is having it with you and being able to express it and being able to put it on the record and know who you are and who you're not.
Right. What we talked about last week.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, having it with you and being able to put it on the record and knowing who you are is the most important thing. Whether you have it situated with the State Department or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. I appreciate it.
No problem. Okay, Michael. All right.
See you over there.
No problem. I'll talk to you guys later. Okay.
Thank you, CW.
You bet. Brother John, thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, now what's really important that everyone on this call should understand is how fluid the team is to interact with itself for your benefit, whether it comes to call a GW into a matter, or Bernie into a matter, or Chris Ann into a matter, or a half a dozen other people that operate behind the scenes you never even hear about. This is how we work. This is how it's put together, and it's all to your benefit. Anything else, Kent? We've got Michael back again.
Yeah, I do have a couple other things. John, not related to the subject you talked about tonight, but I was speaking to somebody the other day who told me that public buildings, and I raised this issue last night, but not to the extent that I would right now, that public buildings or buildings on public land, such as libraries, hospitals, government buildings where you file documents, courthouses, et cetera, can sometimes be considered public and sometimes be considered private. When they're public, there's an issue about the removal or ejectment of people from the premises as opposed to when it's private. Have you ever heard of any such thing? I mean, I can understand a living man or woman wearing a couple of hats, but I'm having trouble understanding how land can be at one time public, at another time private.
Technically, all land is owned by somebody. Now, technically, also, the U.S. government, District of Columbia, 10 square miles, District of Columbia, cannot have any more land other than that which is assigned for air bases, penal institutions, etc. Now, what it means is that because this technically is a government of the people, by the people, for the people, that technically the citizens own the land, so it technically would be always public property. But there's been a deception that's occurred, and what happens is when cities incorporate, the land is held by the corporation and not the individuals any longer, and these corporations, many of them in the Articles of Incorporation, is very specific that they do not make their beneficiary or the individuals the local citizen. It is the corporation itself, which is very, very hard to work with there. But in certain cases, individuals many years ago made arguments that they didn't want the city to be liable, or they didn't want the people, i.e. the elected officials, to be liable for acts or commissions of error or omissions, or not just negligence, but malice with intent. So to that end, the cities were incorporated to protect also the individuals sitting on the the commissioner's board and the mayors and the mayor pro tem and all these other individuals that were sitting in all of these offices, and including the police chief. Remember, the police chiefs are hired. They're assigned by mayors. Sheriffs are elected officials. All elected officials have a bond. That's what protects them. The police, et cetera, and all these other hired individuals, the way they protect them is with a corporate veil. To that end, the buildings that they have are technically property in their minds. They believe that they are property of the corporation and not the citizens, and that the responsibility of opening it up to the citizens' use and benefit, that only during those times they say that it is technically public property, but when it says it closes at 5:30, technically it's they say it becomes a private institution. And I use the words they say, because it's gone both ways in court.
Okay, so they could claim, in other words, after business hours, this is now private property, therefore we could eject you because there's no intent to keep this open past, let's say, 5 o'clock as an example. But if you're there between 9 and 5 when the building is open, then it would be considered public property for the purposes of removal or ejectment or trespass.
That's the argument that city and state attorneys make.
Okay. So this is kind of they could bend and twist this all over the place, obviously. This is kind of at their at their discretion or will. At least that's the argument that they would make.
Now, a side note is that three times when this, over the probably the last 40 some odd years that it's been brought to my attention, we pushed it all the way to the point where they dropped it before it came for decision at the appellate court, because this a government of the people, by the people, and for the people cannot be sold or parted off to a corporation or to any private entity, and that is theft and stealing and malfeasance. And but they said the people that incorporated the city was in 1893, that was one of them. One of the cities was incorporated in 1876, I was there for the centennial, and we had that court case in the state district court, and we were getting ready to go up to the U.S. District Court when they decided to non-suit. They absolutely did not, the state of California did not want something that was that strong of a decision on the records. But nobody that I know of that's actually, whether we would have won or not, I can't state this to this day, but all three times, and all three times in the state of California, they non-suited when we pushed that issue, that they said, no, this is now private property. But that's just a side note. There's no opinions at an appellate court level to support that yet.
So this has never gone. This has never gone to an appellate court level, never gone to the U.S. Supreme Court then that you know of?
Not that I know of, sir.
Okay. All right. I had one other question, but it... Yeah, go ahead.
You had any other question?
I did have another question, but Mike was saying that he wanted to move on because he had other questions, so I could hold it till another time if he likes, unless you have time for it.
I'll let Michael call that ball.
Okay.
No, go for it. Go for it, Kent, and then we'll finish up with Mike in Las Vegas again.
Okay. So my other question is on a traffic case. Actually, is the police officer with the blue light special, so to speak, is he not making an assertion that, number one, you're in commerce when he's stopping you, and number two, that he's also alleging that you're one of their citizen 14th Amendment slaves. And if he's asserting that, wouldn't that be a case that would be appropriate for removal to a U.S. district court? Or do you think that just makes it unduly complicated? You were talking about traffic before, so I thought about this.
Just, and we're discussing just traffic infractions right now, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. On this one, I'm gonna play the jurisdiction card on this one, and you'll see why in a moment. While I have some reservations, I'd love to play this card, but he has no clue what the jurisdiction is before he stops you. In his mind, you might be one of somebody under his jurisdiction. Most of them automatically, because then man makes God in his own image, and our typical macho American male egos write checks our butts can't cash. I mean, that we are largely in charge. I believe that anybody and everybody out there is automatically under our jurisdiction. And to that end, even federal marshals are allowed to stop anybody. But what is the test of their jurisdiction when a diplomat is stopped? The officer is allowed to proceed until the potential defendant does what?
Informs them.
Shows him his diplomat, his passport, or other evidence that he has diplomatic immunity, correct?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. What happens if your status has been corrected and after you've got your computer identification corrected, what happens if all of a sudden you decide to request a passport card and it has that little magnetic strip on it? And when you're pulled over, you say, officer, good evening. This is your license and insurance, please, and registration. You say, officer, I've been instructed to give this to you to have you scan first. Here's the insurance paperwork and here's my registration. Although you already know the registration because you already ran the plate when you pulled me over. But could you scan that card first? And when he scans it, all of a sudden he realizes you're an American national. And then he says, could you please slow down, sir, and gives you your ID back? But if even a diplomat, if they fail to produce their passport or evidence that they are legally entitled to diplomatic immunity, can they be prosecuted? Absolutely. 100%, fullest extent of the law. And all the way up until now, in certain cases, if it's already been adjudicated and they didn't say one word, there's a few sites that I know of where individuals who were diplomats kept their mouth shut because they were embarrassed about what was happening. One of them was involved with a 7-year-old girl, didn't want anything to do with it, actually went to Chino Men's Prison. I met him when he was in the clink in 1981, when I was working with an early release program with some of the local Southern California justices. And his cellmate was the one that was my early release that was coming into my, come to live at my home. His cellmate was the one that made me aware of his political status. And I asked him why he didn't. Because he had complete diplomatic immunity from prosecution. And it was very simply, his father would have had him killed if he would have found out he would have been with a 7-year-old girl in his own country.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that makes a point. They can prosecute you until you prove that you're not under their jurisdiction. And if you do it the very, very first thing, and as tactfully and pleasantly as possible by something no simpler than supplying them with your passport card. How hard can that be?
Okay, so are you saying, without me putting any words in your mouth, are you then saying that, let's say, that police officer became difficult for whatever reason about accepting the card, or he was so macho he's not going to do it that way, you know, he wants to see a driver's license?
Okay.
Well, at that point in time...
No. You give him the card with your driver's license.
Okay, well, everybody wouldn't necessarily have a driver's license.
Excuse me? John, that's just to let you know, that's going against what GW had said.
Okay. I'm going to make a point. I'm going to make a point here. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Regardless of what you have for a driver's license, and Michael knows what I think of driver's licenses, but you're the most fine, solid, pleasant citizen that walked the face of the earth. You give him whatever he wants, but the moment he gets to that passport card, he's going to stop. And it doesn't make a difference whether you gave him your mother's recipe for cookies. He's going to stop. Most of them will stop. Some of them will get a little grouchy and meowchy. Now, let's say that you get cited for no state driver's license. Have you ever been cited for that before?
Plenty of times.
Okay. Okay, we're going to role play. You're the judge and I'm the defendant. I'm you. And you state versus John, no state driver's license. How do you plead? Well, Your Honor, I have a question. No, this isn't a hearing. This is... How do you plead? Guilty, not guilty, or no contendere? Well, I still have a question. Just guilty, not guilty, or no contendere. But I don't understand why I'm here, Your Honor. Well, you got cited. You didn't have a state driver's license. What do you mean? I still don't understand. How can you not understand? Okay, what's your question? Well, good question, Your Honor. Thank you for asking. See, a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal. Isn't that correct, Your Honor? Well, of course it is. And, if I don't have this license, I can't go to work on, drive my car to go to work on Monday or church on Sunday or shopping on Wednesday night, or if my son cuts his foot on a glass bottle, I can't take him to the hospital to save his life. Would that be considered a deprivation of civil rights under color of law under 18 U.S.C. 242 and potentially a capital crime? I've never walked out of a courtroom yet and been charged, or the people I was with been charged. In fact, one of them, there was over 100 individuals where the judge that day in that courtroom dismissed all their cases. And I've been advised that that particular justice, Michael, I found out she is retiring on December 1st, but her bailiff said that she has not convicted a single person of no Texas driver's license since that day I was in her court 4.5 years, almost 5 years ago. And that Houston police officers just don't write tickets for no Texas driver's license in the city of Houston anymore and Harris County. They're substantially reduced because they know if it ends up in her court, she won't sentence him. But you see the point there? I haven't had a Texas driver's license since 1993. So I don't brandish a passport card. Most of the time I ask the officer that. Well, that's a good question. Well, why don't you have a Texas driver's license? Well, that's a good question. Would you like an answer? And they almost invariably always say, yes, I would. And I ask them, I says, well, how about if we role play? You be the judge and I'll be the defendant. Wait, I am the defendant. you know, and you're going to, you know, and I coach him through it, and we end up usually laughing and sometimes hysterically and hilariously. And I even had one officer say, Mr. Fiala, would it be okay if I gave you a ticket? That lady hit you. And if they find out that you didn't have a Texas driver's license, you know, they're going to come down on me. I says, I'm honored and pleased to accept whatever citation you would like to write me. And that's the event that I ended up in that judge's courtroom for. And I told him he can cite me. That was the only thing he was on the citation, you know. But it's all in how you respond. At least I think it is. Do you have any other questions?
No, I think I want to think about that a little more based on my original questions about, you know, my original question about the one who asserts must evidence the assertion, you know, once challenged. And I'm still, even with your answer, I'm still thinking about my original 2 points about the assertion that you're in commerce and the assertion that you're a citizen. But I do understand what you're saying about, you know, they can move ahead until you actually prove otherwise. But then, of course, I asked the question about, well, what if they don't take the card and they go ahead and move ahead anyway? Then could you exercise that assertion issue?
Absolutely. You now, tactfully and diplomatically, would you consider yourself a God-fearing man?
I'm sorry, what?
Would you consider yourself a God-fearing person?
Absolutely.
There, in the Judeo-Christian writings that they call the Bible, they often call the Word of God the sword of the Word. Have you heard that term before?
Not put quite like that. Something similar, but not quite like that.
Yeah, they call it the sword of the Word.
Okay.
And now there are individuals that yield a sword, claim to be God's servant, and they slash and gash, and by the time, and they say, you know, and they talk about how the cords of sin binds the captive. And if the person's hands are tied behind their back and there's big heavy ropes on them and they're tied, their feet are tied and they're on kneeling down, you know, in the I'm about to get shot or executed mode, and the cords of sin are binding them in their hands and the feet, is it proper to take that sword and slash and gash till you finally get the cords cut? Or do you go in there and surgically, very carefully, go in and gently cut those cords so that you don't cut up the individual?
The latter.
Okay. What we're doing is we're going in there very tactfully. There are some people that there have been some, and Texas was pronounced very prominent for one of our organizations, which was less than tactful sometimes, and some of our acts here in Texas were less than proper, where we called ourselves a republic and we said this is the law and that's the law, but we were like the unskillful individual that instead of using the sword of liberty to very carefully cut the cords that would bind the free citizens, we took those swords and we slashed and gashed and sometimes lopped off people's hands and their feet. They were no longer bound, but they lost a hand or some fingers or a foot, you know, and did some damage that later on, because the way they did it, they were called into account and some of them got extended vacations at Club Fed, you know. I don't mean Club Med, I mean Club Fed, you know, and so how we proceed tactfully is very, very important. And if they don't recognize are, you know, like the diplomat that they didn't want to recognize the diplomatic passport. And what was that movie with Mel Gibson, something, the fourth rendition where he, the bad guy holds up a passport and says, diplomatic immunity. And Danny Glover shoots him right through the passport in the forehead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not going to work. You know, I mean, we don't want to have a situation like that. Okay. We want to be tactful. And if there's a misunderstanding and misrepresentation, or they choose not to honor it, then it goes to a different level. And, when it goes to those levels, now we have to start, with pleadings in court. And, that's the same level as if we didn't bring anything up, almost. And, to that end, we're working on paperwork and filings that individuals should be able to take with them or submit in advance. And that's what Jennifer Sue was talking about this evening, and what Michael and I spent spent a minute or two today working on. So it's a freedom and liberty is not a destination. It's a journey. And I'm certain everybody on this call will remember the saying, the tree of liberty must be refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants from time to time. And to that end, all those that signed the Declaration of Independence, they at the Second Continental Congress that are on the likeness of the back of the $2 bill, if there was a roll call vote, every man on that engraving was a wealthy man at one time. Only one of them didn't die a pauper. But they knew that if that didn't go, that they were all subject to potentially immediate execution, drawn, quartered, hung, you know, beheaded, you name it, shot. But and if there was a roll call vote, would we be willing to be counted among that number? And that's the question I'll leave you with this evening.
Okay. Thank you for your explanation.
All right. Thank you. Next is Michael. Go ahead. You're unmuted.
Jennifer. Yes. The master file at the IRS, once you correct your status and get your affidavit, can you send that a copy to them so they and registered mail, and they can't deny that they don't have it? Would that be a good idea for them to have it on their master file?
You know, right now, I'm gonna say I want you to re-ask that question on GW's call this coming week, okay? But here's what's happening. There's a software coding that's been going on for almost 22 months now to update to a single national system and they're talking about by 2027 being on the whole U.S., being on NCIC database, you know, the Baskin-Robbins 31 flavor database, everything, immigration, Social Security, the Treasury Department and everything, or State Department, by 2027, actually, I say 2027, it's supposed to be by January 1st, 2028, and this is off the record, by the way, is supposed to be on one huge, humongous database. Until they get those all merged together, yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'll reserve that to ask him for it whenever he's on again. Thank you.
All right.
Are there any other questions?
1 second. We have one more. Jennifer's waiting patiently for the last question for the evening, please. But my machine just burped, so let me see if I have it still up on the phone. just in case. There it is on the phone.
Well,
so
I if you want to enlarge the time just a little bit to take them both, I still have a little bit of blood left in me.
Okay, well, this is just Jennifer, and Jennifer's going to make it short, I bet you. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Thanks. I was just wondering, because when I was pulled over, I did not, I'd just sort of learning about the status and everything, and I didn't have an affidavit or anything with me in the car, and so because I didn't tell him my standing, even though I had sent the letter to Michael, I didn't know if he'd sent it to the State Department or not as yet. Does that mean they could still go ahead, because I didn't originally tell them I was an American national?
Jurisdiction becomes,
that's a good question,
Jennifer.
That's a good question, Jennifer. Michael, did you want to take a swipe at that before I did?
I just wanted to say that jurisdiction can be challenged at any time. If you have something that's in the future that you know is coming against you, if you have something that's presently happened, if you have something that occurred 20 years ago and you were found guilty and you served your sentence, jurisdiction can be challenged at any time.
Okay.
Actually, Michael's statement is much stronger than he makes it. Challenging of jurisdiction at the appellate court level, they've made it very, very clear that if it can be proved that a court did not have jurisdiction, that is grounds for opening an appeal after, regardless of how many times the case may have been appealed. Actually, his point is much stronger. The rules of civil procedure and the federal rules of criminal procedure make it very, very, they make very specific point. Jurisdiction that can be challenged any time up to the commencement of the case proceedings. Now, while the appellate courts have upheld that jurisdiction, and there's opinions to support that it can be held anytime, if before you have been taken into court, before it's actually gone into court, and you end up making an appearance, and you know what I mean by appearance, not a special appearance, but meaning that you've yielded to jurisdiction, and if you did it so unknowingly, any time before you, up to the time where he says, Lady Smith versus State versus Lady Smith or Lady Jones, you can say, Your Honor, that is your last chance to say, at this time, I would like to challenge jurisdiction to that. And most of the times they're going to say, we've been doing this for 23 years. What could she possibly bring up that we haven't already, covered? Overruled. Michael, what was that something about a California opinion about some place in the state of granola, of the bowl of granola, that a court cannot determine, cannot argue its own jurisdiction?
Lantana versus Hopper, Lantana versus Hopper, 102F, second 188. Also, Chicago versus New York, 37F sup 150. Quote, court must prove on the record all jurisdictional facts related to the jurisdiction asserted. And the other one, which I thought I was just getting ready to read, but I was mistaken, is Rescue Army versus Municipal Court of Los Angeles, 171P second 8. Quote, a court has no jurisdiction to determine its own jurisdiction. End quote.
There you go. And to that end, Jennifer Sue, we're still going to challenge jurisdiction with yours.
Well, thank you. Does every judge actually know about American nationals and that they don't have jurisdiction over them? Do the judges actually know that and just hide it sort of thing?
Sure. Jennifer Sue, I have a friend who is just, she ran for judge in California and got elected. She's a homeschool mom. She just got elected as what the equivalent of a JP court judge would be in California. And back in 2020, and she does not have a law degree. She's working very hard to study the law. She knows a lot about homeschool law because I stood beside her in court quite a few times many years ago, back in the 80s and the late 70s, and I stood beside her children in court with her grandchildren, and. But she knows, I'll tell you, she knows a lot about homeschool, but a lot of this other stuff she doesn't know about. The point that I made earlier about Jimmy educating not just the judge, but the prosecutor, so that after 45 minutes, the prosecutor, it was like Eureka. He had an epiphany. He says, you know what? The prosecution moves to dismiss. If we can go into court like that and educate, especially the newbies, and then also the old bees that somehow got in, stuck in, that barnacle got stuck on the side of the ship. I mean, that the candidate continued to get reelected but never learned a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Finally educate them. No, Jennifer, none of those people can be assumed to understand anything. They're people
okay.
just like you and me that all of a sudden decided they wanted, some of them are people just like you and I. There's probably 10 or 20% that could be a mirror image of you or me, but they just decided they wanted to try to be a judge and make a difference. Do they have a time to study all this case law and everything else, especially now that they're a judge? That's why it's very important for us to be tactful.
John, let me ask you this. You've read my collection of work from a dozen plus people, which I assimilated in what I call, once we were calling a subject to a king, an essay on jurisdiction, which I was quoting from tonight. I always pull that up anytime you and I have a call together. What's wrong with sending that, a brief and call it a brief in support for a jurisdictional challenge, and it's just or not even go that way, not even just hand it to them directly, and say I want you to read this because I want you to understand who I am and where we're going to go with this. If you say where we're going to go with it, you're taking the lead role. You're being the authority, not the judge, not the prosecutor. You're saying to them kindly, this is where we're going to go with it. So they read through it and they get the understanding of jurisdiction. When they get to the bottom of it, the last couple of pages, it's about challenging jurisdiction. And more importantly, the very last thing is what you can do about it, i.e. deprivation of rights under color of law. So what if they have that in their hand before it ever gets to court?
We did send that to them with my affidavit and the not guilty plea. We sent them all of that information. I'm pretty sure.
We were once colonists.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it was but it was all the court cases. Like there were pages of court cases, and they have all of the ones that you're mentioning. I believe we sent to them.
The essay
it takes you by the hand and walks you through it. It's a story. It walks you through. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, actually, Michael, I remember I said there were 8 topics that I'm working on briefs for, like the
right.
Three Apples brief.
Right.
Yours is one of them.
Okay. Good to know.
Yeah. Yours is one of them. There are 8 topics that I'm working on briefs for that so far, and as I have the funds, I'm paying my team to to shepherdize the briefs and go through and the ones that could use a little bit more shepherdization, they're going to do it, and we're working on those. And yeah, I'm working on a brief for shortly here that will be just like what your brief does. And there's a handful. There may be some contributions that we've already started to put into it, but I have not had the chance. I'm fighting some fires and some time right now with ladies in three states.
Right, I know what you're doing.
You and I were working on with today, you know,
yeah.
And
yeah,
and then I've got the I've got and. For everybody on this call, in a week or two, a couple of weeks, we may have a brief that will deal with a little bit of Second Amendment rights and 16th Amendment issues, and or the correct application or incorrect application of the 16th Amendment. This is the way we're going to put this when it comes out. If you have interest in reviewing this brief and providing your peer review and constructive criticisms, it'd be our honor and privilege. What you want to do is send your email address to Michael with the term, the exact word, peer review, nothing more in the subject line. Just send an email with peer review. Michael will start an email address
list.
Book and with
an
that.
Email list.
Yeah, an email list with that. And when we get ready from time to time for peer review type topics like this, and as a test, what we'll do is, you know, the sites that Michael just quoted, we can send those out to you just as a test, so that the moment you get the moment you send up your name with peer review, Mike, yes, that's not all. If you the pay by cash will also include this Ginsu knife set, sumo wrestler not included, but we'll also include Michael's three sites on jurisdiction tonight, and we'll send that right out to you so that you know that you are on the peer review list. And what will happen is that when we get this next one ready to go, we'll share it with you, and it would be our honor and privilege if you would peer review this work. This work will not, at the time you receive it, will not have been shepherdized yet. And when I say shepherdized, and if anybody doesn't know what the term shepherdized means, that's where you take an argument and you apply all of the case law, statutes, opinions, and that apply or could apply to it, and other law references, so that the first one I was asked to boil it down to third grade reading level and just a straight argument with as less reference to statutes as possible. Then they said, then take that and shepherdize it, but they want two separate of this. Actually, the folks that are requesting this have asked for two separate of each one of these eight topics we're working on. But if you send your an email with the term peer review, only nothing else in the subject line, Michael will add you to an email list, and it'll be our honor and privilege from time to time to share with you some of these things that we've got cases pending before appellate courts right now and U.S. District Courts, and we'll share the briefs with some of the briefs that we're using in these cases with you exclusively and on the peer review basis. And if you accidentally shared it with somebody else or put it in a newspaper or on the internet, so be it. That's up to you. But we're going to share it on the basis of getting the honor and the privilege of your peer review. With that, I turn it back over to Michael to close.
Sure. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening, as always. I want to thank John for actually suffering through us tonight. He really should have canceled his part of the call, but he soldiered up, and I appreciate that very, very much. I want to invite you to invite your friends to these calls. I'd like the calls to grow, and I'd like more people aware of the work that Bernie does and GW does and John does and as collective part of the team. And so until next week, I want to thank everybody. Good night and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.
Thank you.